يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. You're back with Middle East Analysis on catholicnews.org.uk, where we are joined again by Dr. Harry Hagopian, the Bishop's Consultant on the Middle East North Africa region, and to ream it off again, international lawyer, political commentator. Do you want to add anything?
No, I'm quite happy with that. You can always say he's also Armenian.
Ah, yes, also Armenian, if you didn't know that already. So, yeah, we're getting to the serious nitty-gritty of this Middle East analysis, and we're looking at Syria, we're looking at Homs, of course, which is in particular focus at this moment in time. I'd like to touch a little bit on the impact on neighbouring Lebanon, but let's stay with that. Let's stay with Homs in particular. Now, the question comes up so often about non-violent versus an armed response. I mean, is this, we're really running out of ideas here when it comes to basically stopping this bloodshed that's seen some 7,000 people die and some horrific images. Journalists we see dying now as well. So what do we do? You know, what can we do as an international community?
It's a very difficult situation that Syria finds itself in, James. It's really, really horrendous. It's heartbreaking. Some of the suffering, some of the calamities, some of the pain that has been inflicted on parts of Syria. And what is really remarkable about Syria is that whilst parts of it are pretty much in a situation of war, real war, other parts are quite calm, as if nothing is happening. So in some parts of Damascus, the capital, and in Aleppo, the commercial capital, people are going about their businesses unaware that there is, well, aware, but you know what I mean, unaware that there is so much destruction and so much violence happening, whereas in other parts of the country, whether in the south, whether in the north or the west, there are other areas where it is really, really bad. And the question that is often asked to me is, why this violence? Isn't there a way, now that the regime is talking about this amendment or reform of the constitution, which was just put to a referendum in Syria, whether it's not possible to basically give up the protests, the demonstrations, the uprisings, even the militarized uprisings, and just basically negotiate with the regime? And what I say to those people is that, unfortunately, they do not know the reality of Syria. Syria is not the UK. Syria is not Europe. Syria is not one of those countries where you would have the rule of law, where you would have the ability to protect your fundamental rights. What scares most of those protesters is that if they were to give up their arms, if they were to even give up their protests and go back into their homes and say, okay, let's go back to square one and let's negotiate with the president and the Damascus regime in order to see how we can move forward, what scares those people are that a lot of them would be hunted down, literally, taken to prison, tortured, and God help them, what will happen to them, because they are viewed as basically traitors who have risen up against the regime.
So, Harry, are you saying that arms from an opposition perspective cannot be put down?
Well, what I'm saying is that we have passed the point where we can go into this nice Western idea in some people's minds of, let's all sit down around a conference table and let's basically thrash this out and see how we can map the future out for Syria. I think we are past that. There is too much vindictiveness, too much blood has been spilled, too much has happened. What I was saying constantly, if you remember, James, in the past, I was saying, please God, let the opposition not become militarized. Let the opposition not take up arms. Let this be peaceful demonstrations. And whilst it is true that most of the demonstrations are still peaceful demonstrations, there is more and more an increasing use of arms by the opposition, by what is known as the Free Syrian Army. And in a sense, we can always justify that, if justify is the appropriate word, and perhaps it isn't, that when you're being basically shelled, attacked, killed day in, day out, you have to defend yourself. So it's not that those protesters decided to go and start shooting. It's only that it's the only way that they can preserve their lives and save themselves and their families. So in one sense, I can understand it. But in another sense, the reason why I kept saying about the violent and non-violent nature of those massive demonstrations across places like Dar'a, like Homs, like Hama, like Deir ez-Zor, like Idlib, is not to give you my opinion, but let me basically quote a peace activist, but somebody who has a lot of authority, and some of you, our listeners, might actually know him, an American by the name of Gene Sharp. I don't know if he means anything to you, James, but Gene Sharp was a political theorist, and he's famous because he wrote that very, very well-known pamphlet, Dictatorship to Democracy, in which he basically talks that the choice of non-violence is not an ethical choice. It is a pragmatic choice because you retain the upper moral argument. Whereas once you go down the road of violence, then that pragmatic choice becomes more questionable, because if you start using rifles, the regime would turn back at you with Kalashnikovs. If you use Kalashnikovs, they would answer back with rockets. If you use rockets, they would use tanks. If you use tanks, they would use warplanes. So in a sense, you are going down a very bloody, slippery slope of confrontation. And that is why Hillary Clinton, U.S. Secretary of State, said that she's worried about civil war and she's worried about all-out confrontation, because the longer these protests and these attacks continue, the longer we are going toward bloodier and bloodier situations.
You know what worries me, especially listening to you talking about Gene Sharp there as well? What worries me is that, you know, It escalates even in terms of, if you like, the no rules, the no holds barred approach to violence as well. Because if the secret police find the protesters and therefore dispense with them in a bloody fashion, the protesters decide to chop heads off and execute when they catch people. So, what on earth stops this from becoming civil war?
Well, it is almost there. It is almost there. In some parts of Syria, for instance, in Homs, that we see every day in that neighborhood, which is called Bab Amr, which has about 28,000 inhabitants in there, people already talk about civil war. People are talking about civil war in other parts of Syria, whereas in some other parts, as I was saying, it is much, much quieter. Interestingly enough, James, I was talking to a Syrian a few days ago, and I told him actually this. I said, is there no way that the Syrian National Council, the opposition as it were, based in Istanbul in Turkey, would be able to come to some sort of an agreement with the regime, with President Bashar al-Assad's regime, in order to basically staunch the violence and stop the bloodletting? And he said to me, he looked at me, he said, Harry, have you ever read a book by Mustafa Khalifa called Al-Qawqa'a, which means the shell? I said, I've heard of the author, but I haven't actually, I must admit, I haven't read the book. He said, read it, because it is mind-numbing. It is the story, published in 2008, of what happens in one of the notorious prisons in Syria called Tadmur. And he says the torture, the inhumane treatment of the prisoners and the inmates in that book about that prison, that is what would happen in Syria today if we stopped and we were all rounded up and taken to prison. We would also end up in torture centers. And this is one of the worries about the opposition, is that they have crossed the Rubicon, just as the regime has. And in a sense, the only way out is it's your way or my way, but there is no halfway. And this is why I think it is imperative upon the international community, upon the League of Arab States, upon us within the European Union, to try find a way. If the way forward is by increasing the sanctions, as we have done with freezing the assets of the Syrian Central Bank, by banning some more people from traveling outside Syria, if the economic sanctions are the answer, fine. But people are dying, and we should pray for them and remember them, whoever those people are. What worries me is that we have now 70, 80 deaths every day. How many weeks and months is this going to continue before we have a solution to this problem? As again, U.S. Secretary of State said, and as many other analysts have said, this is something that could be with us for some while yet. And if so, is almost a question of something happening for the first time ever in the history of the Arab world, and that is that the people, not the army, not a foreign power, but the people of that country, in this case Syrians, would succeed, if they do, in toppling their president and their leader. That would be a first for the country if it happens, but we're not yet there by any stretch of the imagination.
And being antagonistic, I suppose, again, you said earlier in the podcast that Homs isn't necessarily Damascus or Aleppo or other places in the country. If that was to occur, surely it would take a unified front from a great many areas in Syria.
Absolutely. It would take a unified front from many, many areas. It would mean that the whole country would have to be mobilized against the regime, which it is not at the moment. But part of the responsibility for that lies perhaps with the Syrians themselves, because the opposition is so fractious, so fragmented, that even if we as a West wanted to pile up the pressure, ramp up the pressure, and do more by perhaps recognizing the Syrian National Council as the official representative of the Syrian people, the way we did with the Libyans, we can't do that, because who represents the Syrian National Council? They're so busy fighting amongst themselves that they don't even have time to use a common address or a common stance vis-a-vis the West and vis-a-vis Syria itself. No wonder that China and Russia are able pretty much recklessly to go on protecting all that the regime is committing in the country, because the opposition, for what it is there, whether outside the country or inside the country, has so many different agendas that it is not able yet to apply one unified stance. And I'll give you an example. The United Nations Human Rights Commission came up with a report after an inquiry recently, which basically labels how many crimes against humanity the Syrian regime and certain people within that regime have committed in the country. Now, if I put my legal hat on, I would tell you that this is a precursor for indicting those people to the International Criminal Court, which is what should happen. Now, for that to happen, for any policy to become valid, we need some sort of closure in the country, but we also need an opposition that speaks with one voice and that puts aside its own internal differences in the face of a much greater objective.
You know, in recent days, I've obviously read different levels of analysis on what's going on primarily in Homs and the question of civil war and whether that will extend to the country as a whole. Now, a common theme, sectarianism is a common theme, mm-hmm. but they also tend to look at the Christian communities mm-hmm. of Syria and point to them as supporting the regime. Mm-hmm. Now, naturally, I think to myself, oh, how horrific. Why would Christians support such bloodletting and such barbarism? Can you explain it to me? Because I'm sure that's too simplistic an approach from me.
Well, in a sense, James, it is not, because the Christians are caught between a rock and a hard place, in a sense. Christians in Syria by nature, Christians anywhere by nature, I should hope, are people who would advocate for justice, for peace, for reconciliation amongst peoples. So in a sense, I would have thought that the aims of the Arab awakening across the whole region, whether in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt, in Yemen, and certainly in Syria and others, is very much something they could identify with. However, what is happening with Syria at the moment and the Christian communities is that they're looking at what is happening in Egypt, the tensions between the Christian Copts there and the regime. They're looking much more at what happened in Iraq, where, remember, we as the West invaded the country, wrought havoc with the country, and left it with half the Christian population, a substantive number of them, actually either were internally displaced, fled the country into neighboring countries as refugees. Such as Syria, such as Jordan. And imagine those Christian refugees from Iraq in Syria who are now wondering where we ran out of our own country into Syria and look what we've got ourselves into. They look around them and they see what happens when regimes change, when a more Islamic nature creeps into the politics of the region. And they say, you know what, better the person who gives us a little bit of freedom to carry on with our lives than staking our futures on something which is quite a gamble if you look at it from a Christian perspective of somebody living there rather than somebody like you and I analyzing it from here.
So this isn't really tacit support for the Bashar al-Assad regime. This is actually more a comfort, if you like, with a secular governing authority.
I think it is basically not so much a tacit support for the regime. I think if tomorrow all those Christian communities across the whole region, including in Syria itself, were told, listen, we really need to change this regime. We need to reform it. We need to have ironclad constitutional guarantees, not the kind of farcical theatricals that are being done now by reforming this law and that law, which we know that tomorrow could actually not work. But if they were told, you know, we're going to have a system where the rule of law applies, where each and every community would have their fundamental rights, and those are clear rights under international law, then I bet you that most of the Christian communities would be quite willing to support the uprisings across the whole region, including in Syria. What they're facing now is a situation where, unfortunately, they don't know what is going to come. They're not sure that what is going to come would be any more respectful of their rights than what they have today. And therefore, it's a human nature to say, yes, you know, I do want all those lofty principles of peace, justice, equality and all that. But at the end of the day, I know I live in the Middle East. I know the culture of my region. And I'd rather have somebody who, in some sense, I know how to deal with rather than open the sluice gates for so much uncertainty later. It's human. It's perhaps even understandable, but it's not necessarily fathomable.
Perhaps it's the luxury we have in that we can look upon it and make comments like
precisely.
I may.
Precisely. I mean, one of the things I feel from the region when I'm in the region is that the realities as we see them from outside are different from the way they are inside. Even veteran journalists, veteran analysts who know the region, speak the language probably as well as anybody else, still lack that cultural instinct which would identify them as people from the region rather than people in the region. And in that sense, I always respect, this is why I always respect even I, who knows the region, was born into the region, even I sometimes pause, listen to the people there and say, look, I respect what you're saying, because at the end of the day, I can always rush back to my little pad in London and forget what is happening there, whereas those people day in, day out have to deal with those issues. And for that, I don't only raise my hat, I offer a prayer every day.
Food for thought there, Harry. I take that point entirely. Thank you very much for your insight. Always appreciate it. And please do stick with us on catholicnews.org.uk. We may not have the luxury of having Dr. Harry Hagopian in the studio, but we will try and bring his unique insight to you by other means. So, Harry, thanks again.
My pleasure.